Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And we're going to begin with just one email. This time Gabe's got it right there in front of him on his phone.
This is from Adam. It's really, really short. And he just, I mean, this is our miner, our Canadian miner on the Canadian plains, spends most of his time.
I'll spell that. That's M-I-N-E-R.
Yeah.
Underground.
Oh, yeah. And he spends most of his days hundreds of meters underground. And he asked me, how's your mesh doing, Gabe? And what he meant by that was that piece of mesh that was put into my stomach at the end of last year. I had an operation for a hernia, and I had a horrible time with it in the wake of the operation, weeks afterwards, even months afterwards. And now, Adam, thank you for asking, because it's gone. All the pain, all the nerve damage that I was worried was going to be a chronic thing, and I was never going to recover from it, it's gone. I haven't mentioned it or spoken about it since, complaining about it at the beginning of this year, because it's absolutely gone.
And that does make me feel better hearing you say that, because I haven't either. And I haven't followed up or asked how you doing, buddy, with that mesh. It just totally vanished from my mind, too. So In the best way, it's gone.
Thank you, Adam.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. So real quick here, a couple quick studies. We're going to begin in the Amazon rainforest. So primarily in Brazil, but a lot of countries as well, with a piece of that forest. And kind of bad news, Nature Communications. I mean, it was known for a while that the amount of rainfall falling down on the Amazon rainforest every year is dropping, and kind of significantly. So it's, at first I kind of passed over it because it said roughly two centimeters drop. It's like, oh, well, okay, they get a lot of rain though, but it's annually. And over the course of, or from the years of 1985 up until 2020, so up until recently, 35 years, that's a lot. And it keeps happening. Why is it happening? Well, that's what they're looking at in this paper called How Climate Change and Deforestation Interact in the Transformation of the Amazon Rainforest. University of Sao Paulo, Brazil, also the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry here in Mainz, Germany. Long story short, and this is, I thought, genuinely surprising, most of that loss in rainfall, 75% of the loss in rainfall, is because they've cut down the trees.
Wow.
Which is not what I would have expected. Trees, with their huge root systems, they, I don't know if the verb is transpirate, but it's called transpiration. They're constantly sucking water, leaching water out of the ground and putting it back up into the atmosphere.
Well, now that anybody with a lawn knows that.
What, that is sucking water out of the...
Yes, yeah. Because the grass around the tree, some people say it's because the pH levels are changed because of what's falling down from the tree. No, the tree is winning the battle for water against the grass.
Yeah, and kills the grass off.
Yes.
Yeah,
no, so it's sucking all that water up and then evaporating it?
Yes, and that's the part where I was naive. I knew they were sucking it up. I've also seen that too. You're mowing the dead grass around a tree, watching it vanish.
Yeah.
But it puts it's responsible for somewhere up to 40% of rainfall.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of stuck thinking, well, but it's all cyclical. A tree creates the rain, and the rain falls on the tree, and then the tree creates. No, it does more than that. It also that new cloud system, those vapors, end up creating low pressure that pulls more moisture in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, long story short, by cutting the trees, you diminish the rainfall, which leads to even less rainfall, meaning I believe that the solution has to be planting more trees. Kind of a negative story. I'll just add on top of it a very quick positive story, because one part or connected of the Amazon rainforest, it's in French Guiana. That's also where Europe launches its rockets.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about space debris, all this junk up in space, constantly circling the planet, potentially causing cascading impacts and all sorts of pollution up in the atmosphere, or all sorts of pollution up in low Earth orbit and beyond. And three missions are going to happen sometime soon. Don't know the exact date. They're going to launch from that spaceport in French Guiana. And one of them, Spanish company, has an ET pack. The purpose of these missions is let's try new things, new tech. Maybe it's commercially useful. It's going to imagine a satellite that otherwise would just hang out there in space and hit stuff and create more junk.
Yeah.
It unveils a 1 kilometer long aluminum tape tether behind it.
A tether.
A tether, that's it. That tether interacts electrically, creating a current, with the geomagnetic or kind of plasma field around Earth. That field goes way higher than our atmosphere.
Yeah.
A lot of these satellites and things are are obviously higher than our atmosphere. And so it would use that tape to create drag.
Okay.
And then slowly drop down toward our atmosphere and burn up. And okay. It'd be a really cheap and potentially easy way of decommissioning satellites or anything up in orbit that needs to come down, but without using things like gas canisters or requiring more energy to get them down. And this is one potential solution. So that's pretty cool.
We're going to come down from space, but we're going to keep with the idea of moving, motion sickness. Do you get it?
Increasingly with age, now that you say that, when we go to like a theme park where there are rides, I cannot do those the way I used to.
Yeah.
And to a lesser extent, sometimes on boats.
Yeah. I belong to one of the 30% of, according to a study that was done in Europe, people who deal with car sickness as a recurring problem. In that study, over half of the people asked, and they were all adults, had encountered it, but 30% deal with it on a daily basis.
I have driven, I was going to say hundreds, thousands of kilometers or miles with you, and you've never been sick, have you?
I can mask it. I don't vomit, but I don't feel well. And my daughter Heidi, one of the three daughters, takes after me big time. She gets, I mean, we can't go 10 minutes without her saying I'm going to vomit. Most cuts in Papa.
Yeah.
Or Daddy. So it is a thing. And there was a study done in China about how to help these people, possibly with music. I'm going to play two clips for you, Connor. And I'm just going to ask you, which one do you think is better for people who are suffering from car sickness? Hey, Thomas? Here, next song.
So, number two, I'm not even in a car and I kind of feel sick. I feel sickened with dread and foreboding at the horror that awaits me.
Okay, the way I found those two songs was we have this database of songs here at Deutsche Welle, and I chose Joyful for the first song and Sad for the second song.
See, I felt existential dread.
There was some emotional tension in there as well, you know. So,
but it's clearly the Joyful one that...
We have 30 drivers in this study, and they were five different groups. And the first group, no music at all. So they drove for a while until they got motion sickness. And they did this with machine learning surveys, but also machine learning so they could pinpoint exactly how much motion sickness these people were feeling. And what they were measuring was how much does that motion sickness get reduced by music. The first group didn't listen to any music at all after driving and feeling this motion sickness.
Okay, so they've driven, they've gotten sick, they stop, and they're in a quiet room.
Yeah, they get no music at all. The other four groups got a song of a different music style. So the first one got a joyful song, like you heard. The next one, a soft song, a passionate song, and a sad song. And they were looking into what difference the music has with regard to how long it takes you to recover. Joyful, you recovered fastest. So it went down by 57%. Soft, it also similar, 56%. Passionate, it only went down by 48%. And sad, it went down by less than 40%. Now, the important number is, without any song at all, you went down 43. So the only song...
So sad actually made it worse.
Sad made it worse.
you're feeling sick, motion sickness. You step out of the car for a while, and if sad music is on, you're going to feel worse rather than start the recovery.
They also had these people driving. They were measuring with an EEG. They were looking at the brain. And motion sickness is in the occipital lobe in the back of the brain where the visual cortex is located. So they could see exactly what was going on when the music was happening. The disturbance returned to normal more with the joyful and soft music. And with sad music, it took longer. And what they're talking about there is emotional tension. That sad music, the reason why you said you felt sick. Those are negative emotions, and the tension stays longer, and you feel sick for longer.
Okay. So the lesson for you and for everyone out there is if you're feeling car sick or nauseous as a result of movement. Positive, joyful music.
Yeah.
I'm just going to stick to China here for a quick final study. And again, with very clear takeaways for all of you out there, what they're trying to figure out is when it comes to relationships, you kind of, they present a dichotomy that doesn't really exist. But does a person, like a partner, do they want your sweet words or your sweet actions? That was it. That was the whole purpose. Which of those are more important and crucially, and I'll just quote the title here, who favors sweet actions over sweet words more, females or males? What's the difference there?
Oh.
And so they looked, or they, as part of the study, there were 500 people in China. One caveat, all of them were heterosexual people, heterosexual couples, at the Sino-Britain Center for Cognition and Aging Research in Southwest University. And it was really three studies that they did. And in the first one, all they're saying is imagine your partner and imagine them either saying sweet words. So this could be, I love you, or I hear you, I understand you, supportive things, or sweet, what they call sweet actions. And these are basically chores around the house or going out and doing things, running errands, going grocery shopping, okay, and cooking. So imagine them doing those things. What's more important to you? What do you prefer? And it was very clear for women that they prefer the actions. So you can talk very sweetly, Gabriel, to your partner, but more importantly, it's the things that you do for them fundamentally, or for each other. And
I'm going to go home tonight and clean the carpet.
And with men, it wasn't quite as clear. They leaned more toward verbal expressions of love or care or support than physical. Two more studies, and the last two studies were basically the same thing twice. They had two different partner profiles. So it'd be like, Gabe, in your case, you're looking at two different women that you could potentially date. And then they just sort of drafted different characteristics for them. One was more action oriented and the other was going to be more sweet and verbal and communicative. And when women looked at two profiles, in this case of men, they wanted action man, 100%. Not 100%, but they drifted more toward action man. And with men, they didn't really care when they were looking at two profiles of women. And the speculation, and this is the end of the paper here, but the speculation is that there is some evolutionary basis for this, because a man could trick a woman with sweet words, but not really with actions. Actions are facts. You've done them. They happened. Whereas words are just words. And that the other way around, if you're a man and you're potentially interested in a woman, if she's doing things, you're not really sure how she feels about you. Yeah. Like, well, she's super productive, but like, does she like me or is she into me?
Yeah.
Whereas those words would, if they're true, hoping they're true, they would indicate that.
Yeah, there's some useful information there.
Do some things. Do things. That's it. That's the takeaway for the guys out there. Do things. And for the ladies out there, yeah, some verbal support for your male partners, in the case of this study from China.
If my wife's listening right now, talk sweet to me, because I'm cleaning the carpet tonight, man. I'm serious.
If there is one document or written record of your life that's probably more important over the long term, over the coming decades and centuries than all of the others, it's your obituary. What other people say about how you led your life.
When you're gone, what words do you want used to describe your life? Or what words would you use to describe somebody's life who is important to you? The reason why we're asking these questions, a study has been done on millions of obituaries, and those texts say a lot more than just what people's lives were.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, my name is Dr. David Markowitz. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Michigan State University. And along with different colleagues of mine across the U.S., we published a study looking at what obituaries reveal about the human condition, what values people emphasize among their deceased.
And David, what do obituaries reveal about the human condition?
What they reveal is kind of amazing. They reveal these personal narratives that really reveal close connections about others, but what they also reveal are these societal things that people emphasize about our culture. And what we like to think about is that our obituaries are not only psychological, but cultural time capsules.
And more specifically, I mean, generally these are going to be positive, right? They're highlighting the positives, but which positives specifically do people choose to have highlighted about themselves or that others highlight about them?
Sure. So a lot of the things are quite positive in obituaries, and they often emphasize what are called personal values related to tradition, which is often a focus on religion. And they often focus on an idea called benevolence or caring for others. So when someone has passed on, people tend to reflect on what they've meant to other people and also what they have focused on in terms of religion and social norms.
How many obituaries did you look at in your study?
We looked at about 38 million obituaries from across the U.S. spanning about 30 years, from 1998 to about 2024.
And so what exactly were you looking for? Common denominators? Or what did the 38 million obituaries that you read through tell you about people and what's important to people?
Sure. So they told us a lot, and there are several findings. I'll break down the first one, and then we can get into many different others. So the first one is that we want to look at what are the things that people are remembered for most. And as I mentioned before, tradition and benevolence, they were in over 80% of all the obituaries. So when you reflect on someone's life, you really focus on their religious faith, and you also focus on their caring for friends and family. A second major thing that we looked at was how cultural events shape how people are remembered. And we looked at three big moments in the U.S., at least, that really shaped how people were remembered, such as the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the 2008 financial crisis, and also the COVID-19 pandemic. And then the third thing we also really wanted to look at is how gender and age stereotypes persist even in death.
I can't get away from those three major events that you just listed. How on earth, I can't imagine an obituary where it was like he was a great father, you know, involved in the church, and what, 9/11 really affected him or something? Like what would be?
Yeah, so let me walk you through that. So basically, there's a whole host of literature in social psychology that identifies how after personal and cultural stressors or times of high distress, people change how they think, feel, and behave in the world. So what we want to look at is after these big cultural moments, these big cultural events, how writing about loved ones shifted after these big things that happened in people's personal and societal lives. So for example, after 9/11, we saw less of an emphasis on security, but more of an emphasis on tradition. So people felt less safe, and this was ever more so for those who were specifically identified having died in New York during 9/11 compared to dying outside of New York. And again, New York being the epicenter basically of 9/11. So we see these big cultural events and cultural moments shifting how people are remembered.
Okay, so it's not an explicit personal or personalized obituary referencing that. It's at the macro level, how these obituaries have shifted after these events. What happened after the others that you mentioned, the financial crisis, COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah. Exactly. Some of the largest patterns happened during COVID, and I often like to talk about that because we're still experiencing some of these effects. If we look from all the way starting about 2019 to 2020, caring for close others has really decreased, and it has not returned even 4 years after. And that's that personal value of benevolence. And this was actually one of our most surprising findings. And it's surprising because if you remember during that time when communities were making extraordinary sacrifices. We were wearing masks, social distancing, trying to take care of the elderly. Obituaries became less likely to emphasize caring for others. And there are several reasons why I think that may be.
Yeah, what in the world is going on there?
Sure. So it's a bit paradoxical, but what I think is really going on here is that this really reflects how in times of crisis and personal distress, pro-social behavior becomes harder and harder to publicly recognize, even when it's widespread, even when you know that people are genuinely caring about other people. What's happening is that perhaps our internal dialogue of events, our internal stressors, may be quite different than our external dialogue and our external expressions of what's going on.
So just to make this concrete, if I were to pass away today and somebody's writing my obituary now, even if I spent a lot of my time, you know, for good causes, helping other people, volunteering, going on the streets, making sure people are taken care of, then if I had passed away prior to the pandemic, that would have been highlighted in my obituary. This is a selfless person who cares for others. And yet that's less likely now after the pandemic.
That's right. It's less likely after the pandemic. Now, the one thing is that it's not deterministic, isn't it? It's not that it happened every single obituary. But what we find is that there's a trend over time since the pandemic where people are less likely to emphasize caring for other people. And again, what we think is going on here is that if we reflect on what we were really experiencing in 2020 and 2021, all of our lives, our social lives, our psychological experiences, they were completely upended. So what was going on internally with us, our ability to sort of process these events, may have been quite different than how we were able to externally express ourselves and how we were thinking and feeling.
And what do you want to leave behind, David, after all this? I mean, it is really morbid to think about your own obituary. And I don't know, I'm fortunate enough not to really know who writes them always, but is it better to write your own autobiography and shape your memory left behind, or should we leave that to others? What are you going to do?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that there are classes that I know that teach, there are classes in the social and psychological sciences that have students actually write their own obituary as like an exercise in expressive writing, and also as an exercise in values and motivations. And what that does is that makes people think about what their priorities are in life. And for me, at least, I go back to someone who I really miss, who passed on years ago, my grandma. And this, I believe, is not necessarily in her obituary, but it's on her tombstone. It's just a very simple phrase: she tried. And why I find that to be really powerful and consequential is the outcome is kind of irrelevant, right? In that phrase, what it means is that the process, the effort we put into everyday life, and also the things that we try to do and we attempt really matter. And it's those who we engage with that really matter. And what I try to do is to live my life by that.
As you were answering this last question, I started thinking about something, and I had like tears start welling up inside. I'm going to have to write the obituary probably for my dad and for my mom soon. How do I do that? Do I look at society, look at what values are important in society, and then somehow find a way to describe how my mom and dad embody those?
Fit.
Is that the way to do it, or do I go hyper individualistic and try and say how unique and amazing my dad was to me? What do I do when I start writing that text?
Yeah, so obituaries are incredibly personal, and they're really important not only in the healing process, but they're also really important in the remembrance process. So the answer to that really lies in what is most comfortable for you and how you want to remember people. What's really important is that doing something just because society does it isn't necessarily the right answer, right? So reflecting on the individual life, what the individual meant to you, and thinking deeply about what you believe that they would want reflected in that obituary probably might strike a happy medium.
And with that said, David, when you looked at all these obituaries and you saw these recurring themes of social values, did it ever make you sad for these people that they had such, impersonal?
Trite. I mean, I hate to use that word here, but it would
feel cliched.
It would feel trite, even though they aren't that. They're highly individualized people, and yet their lasting verbal linguistic recording, the most important thing that 100 years from now possibly will exist of them, or 150, is just part of a large trend that reflect society and not them?
Well, again, I might push back just a little bit. These are written by individuals who really care deeply about people, about the deceased. And if you were to read several of them, especially ones that were reflected in the paper, you'll see that these aren't just generalized abstractions of a life. These are descriptions about how someone was a devoted wife and mother, a caring and solid friend, someone who had such expertise and experience in their profession, for example. And then they go into even more granular details about what a person meant not only to, let's say, their country if they served, or what they meant to each and every individual. Quite often, these are very personalized narratives and stories that people have told about a life. And while it might seem unfortunate to distill a life down to about an average of 175 words, what I can take from that is also that these are public now. So not just can the family and friends remember the individual, but people who may stumble upon them for various reasons can learn about an individual, and their legacy can also live on. So it could be a glass half full view of it, but it's something I certainly believe in.
That was David Markowitz speaking to us from up in Michigan. And I'd like to apologize to the people listening to this right now. I got a little dark there with my questions.
Well, you also apologized to him.
Yes.
And he didn't care at all.
No, but the reason I was pressing him on the unfortunate nature with which obituaries are written was when we were back in Wisconsin over break. A neighbor died, and the words that were written about Jan in the Daily Citizen newspaper, the Beaver Dam paper, they weren't good.
What was wrong with that?
Well, they had a lot of these, not cliches, but she was a devoted family member, and she was a member of the church, and she was a member of this club, and Jan was more than that. Way, way, way more than that.
What would you have written? A line, not the whole thing. That's way too much. But
that's why I asked him how, if I'm going to have to write an obituary, I don't even know where to start. Because the moment you start taking words to try and, encapsulate another human being that means an endless amount to you, you fail.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think Mark...
Tragically.
Mark Twain, you can't capture a flame with art, but it's a painting of a flame, right? You're trying to use words to get as close as you can to the real person. Is it quirks? I think some quirks should be in there. What was quirky about him? What did they do differently than everyone else? That doesn't have to be the whole obituary, but one quirk, the way they opened doors, the way they, I don't know.
Maybe an obituary doesn't have to nail the meaning or encapsulate a human. Maybe it is just another social
construct.
The final social construct. the final one, and then it's over. You're done with your social construct. You're free now.
Yeah.
Well, no more social constructs for Jan.
Yeah. You're still on the stage in a way, or it's still a kind of dramaturgy. It's like the last part of the script.
Yeah.
In a way. We're left without an answer to this. I'm not sure David has one. I'm not sure there is an answer to how one should go about what is a really difficult thing to write. But how
they remain fascinating, though. Wow.
How would you do it? Or do you have tips that we can pass along to people next week? Have you read an obituary that was particularly moving, or the opposite, one that was absolutely outrageous? I've seen those floating around the web. And David, by the way, has promised to send us some of his worst, like the worst examples, the most horrible.
Yeah.
And I don't believe we're going to receive those prior to airing this. And what that means is that in our follow-up episode, we'll read some hopefully like awful obituaries.
If you guys want us to, let us know. Reach out and let us know whether you want to hear some of the horrible descriptions of people's horribly led lives.
SU@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.